Eastern Standard is hosting a year-long monthly series looking at the 19th Amendment, 100 years after its ratification, establishing the right of American women to vote. EKU history professor Jackie Jay has this month's interview.
I'm here today with Sarah Egge, associate professor of history at Center College. She's written a book titled Woman Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest. And today we'll be talking about the specific experience of women's fight for the right to vote in the Midwest. I'll start by asking you to define for us the geographic area of the Midwest. What states do you include in that term, and what brought you to that particular area of research in the first place?
Well, I'm glad to be here. And so there's lots of debate about what states are included in the Midwest. Some people think that it's kind of maybe Iowa is the middle. Some people move it a little closer to Illinois or even Ohio. But generally, it's kind of in the middle or the interior part of the United States. And it does include states like Ohio, all the way over to the Dakotas and then south. And this is where it gets a little bit fuzzy. Maybe Nebraska, maybe even Kansas. Some people put Missouri in there. But again, if you kind of just section off the center part of or the interior part of the United States, that's where we think of the Midwest. The reason I chose the Midwest is because I'm from the Midwest. And I took a class in college on women's history. And when we learned about the women's suffrage movement, I thought that this was fascinating. But then I realized that so much of the research was on either women in the Northeast or maybe women in the West, but there was very little about women in the Midwest. And I had more than a hunch, I would say. I had some lived experience that told me that Midwestern women were fierce advocates of women's rights. And I wanted to know more about women's suffrage in this particular region. And so that's where it really began.
And as your research developed, how did ordinary activist women agitate for the right to vote, and what was significant about their actions and their advocacy?
Well, the first thing we need to know is that it was risky to fight for women's suffrage or really any sort of women's rights cause, in part because these ideas at the time were really radical. And so one of the things that women had above all was their reputations. So anytime they sought to go out and agitate for a particular radical cause or controversial cause, they put those reputations on the line. And so what they had to do then, and what I find so fascinating, is they often banded together and they used existing collective or voluntary associations of women to sort of make a shield for themselves to preserve those reputations. So the organizations that in the Midwest in particular were most in line for women's suffrage were the temperance advocate group, so the Women's Christian Temperance Union, or the WCTU. Federated women's clubs were also very popular at this time in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and they were also often aligned with women's suffrage. But then also lots of church organizations, ladies' aid societies were very popular among Midwestern women, mission societies. And so these were already venerated organizations of women. And these were the places where they could then bring forward women's suffrage. And so you see things like, we want the right to vote so that we can squash the rum power, which is really a pro-temperance or prohibition sentiment. But in fact, that's where that idea came from, is that it's better for us to preserve our reputations if we can band together collectively and come at women's suffrage from sort of a web of activisms already in place.
And what you've said, that women are essentially navigating their gender and social roles at that point, that in certain ways they're working within the expected norm, but in other ways they're pushing back against that. And so could you delve a little more deeply into how people at that time are viewing women's roles and that intersection of religion as religious organizations come into play and how gender roles come into play?
Yes. So Midwesterners are very church-centered at this time and still remain one of the—it's the region with the largest number of churchgoers. And so religious ideas, in particular about gender, were very important for a lot of Midwesterners. And what they believed is that women ought to do as the Bible says, basically serve, obey, be silent, and support in this sort of patriarchal family unit where the husband or the father is at the head. And so this is a system then where there are independent men and then there are dependents, which include wives and daughters, children broadly. And so this then sense of the family unit is really profound, and it's encapsulated in this biblical Christian teaching. And so that gives you a sense of just how much of a big deal this was to talk about women being independent voters or having their own mind and making their own political decisions, when you start to talk about those things, you aren't just talking about a political change. You're talking about a change in the very fabric of the God-ordained family. And people took this seriously in the Midwest. And so I think we forget that sometimes, just how radical these ideas were. But if you think about this in terms of some of these cherished beliefs, it really underscores just how devastating it could be for women if they struck out on their own and started to advocate for women's suffrage. That's why it makes sense then that they would collectively organize to sort of have that power or superiority in numbers.
And it sounds as though other issues like temperance were key issues that then gave women that window to open and to convince the rest of society that this was an acceptable thing for women to then have the vote because they could be instrumental in bringing about those kinds of changes. Was that the predominant argument that women had for gaining the vote? And was that something that was largely accepted by the men in their families and in society more generally? Or was that something that took a long time for them to gain acceptance?
Well, it's definitely the latter. It does take a longer time. And I like to break it up. So the late 19th century is really where we see women starting to navigate the message that they're going to send. And they often strike this message that you've indicated, where this is really women at their moral guidance, where they are able to sort of steer the family away from the perils of drunkenness, for example, or the monster of intemperance. And they're able to do so, again, as women in their cherished roles of the family, but then they start to attach the vote and they say that the vote will also enable us to better protect the home from these vices and corruptions. And this in the Midwest does work, but what also is interesting, by the early 20th century, what had been a period of settlement, white settlement in particular, women had really taken advantage of that opportunity to act as public servants in ways that they could not do in other regions. We are literally building communities, and women are often raising the money to construct the first churches and libraries and schools and public buildings. And so they accrue this civic responsibility. They say that we are responsible, not only are we morally good, but we also understand responsible citizenship. So by the 20th century, they enhance that moral argument of home protection and cleaning up politics by saying that we understand it as good citizens, and good citizens or loyal citizens then ought to have the right to vote. And so the emphasis is not so much on it as a right of individual citizens. It's more on this idea that the vote shows responsibility. And it's a shift when we think about what are these things like voting. Is it a right? Is it a responsibility or a duty? And so we really start to think about citizenship in more profound ways.
And one thing that I have discovered as a result of this series is just how fragmented the experience is across the United States, and that different locales, the traditions of different locales play a huge role. And race is also a very important factor in terms of determining who is allowed to vote and what the rationality for that is. In the Midwest in particular, how does race and ethnicity and immigration and background play a role in the women's suffrage movement?
Yeah, so that's the final ingredient to this story. So you have these white American-born women. They often are middle class, educated, and they often come from the Northeast. And so if you read in my book, I call them Yankees, which when I say that in Kentucky, I think people think of Civil War. Some of these people were Civil War veterans, and they often fought for the Union, but not all of them. Really, Yankees just denotes where they're from, and it's really more of the Northeast. And they come to the region in the 19th century ready to build these communities and settlements. They realize, though, that they need other laborers and workers alongside them to do this work because they feel like they're really building this from scratch. And so immigrants pour into the Midwest as well at this time, and mostly from Europe, primarily from Northern and Western Europe. The number one immigrant group are Germans, and then they're followed by Scandinavians, so Norwegians and Swedish people and Danish and et cetera. And so these people come and they are excited to settle there to also take advantage of this economic opportunity, just as these Yankees were. But they settle sort of in an unsettled way, as I say. The immigrants often settle in rural enclaves and they can avoid assimilating. They send their students to parochial schools that they created, not public schools, which means they can continue to speak their native languages. And so this issue of immigration starts to bubble to the surface over time. And by the 20th century, it becomes a bigger issue, especially as we start to approach World War I, where the United States will increasingly see itself positioned against Germany and Germans. The other big issue that the Midwest has, more profoundly than other regions do, is that in most Midwestern states, these immigrants could vote before they became citizens. And it's one of these inconsistencies of rights, in particular voting and citizenship. They basically could get the right to vote after 2 years of living in the United States when they declared their intention to get citizenship, rather than the full 5-year period of actually residing in the United States and then becoming actual citizens with a certificate. So this produces a conundrum unlike any other region, where you have actual citizens, women, who cannot vote, working alongside, living alongside people who are not citizens, but who can vote. And increasingly, as we get closer to World War I, this question is really about loyalty. How can you trust these Germans who can vote, who've never actually pledged their loyalty because they've never actually undergone that full naturalization process? And that's increasingly what these suffragists will say. They will use these nativist arguments to make their case that women then, white women in particular, should have the right to vote.
And so the suffrage movement in the Midwest is predominantly coming out of that quote-unquote Yankee population, not the immigrant German Scandinavian population. I would imagine that those women are not the ones who are fighting for the right to vote.
Right. Not primarily, right? Most of them are Yankees. There are some. So Minnesota does have the Scandinavian Woman Suffrage Association, although during World War I, they do kind of have to backtrack their activities a little bit. And there certainly are individual examples of some women who were predominant, who were of ethnic, maybe they were Norwegian or German, but there's few. Most of them are Yankees. And it really does see this sort of ethnic divide as the place where women's suffrage plays out in this region.
Really interesting. And what specific examples from the Midwest can you give us that showcase how the movement worked particularly there?
So one of the campaigns I really think illustrate this is the 1918 campaign in South Dakota. South Dakota had 7 amendment campaigns, which is by far the state with one of the largest number of these campaigns. And it's a state that's overlooked in part because national leaders like Susan B. Anthony, Carrie Chapman Catt, they didn't like South Dakota because it had all these immigrants and they kept losing and they kept blaming immigrants for these losses. So by 1917, when the bill was initially proposed, everything seemed like it was going to be the same old campaign where if they won, it would be a feat of strength for them. But what happens is that in the spring of 1917, the United States declares itself on the side of the Allies fighting against Germans. And for the suffragists, this is a key moment. Then the governor of South Dakota adds a clause to what was the normal woman suffrage amendment. So in addition to enfranchising women, it also disenfranchised anyone who was voting on a declaration of intention, that system that we've talked about. And so what it actually does is it changes the entire meaning of the amendment. People no longer call it the Woman Suffrage Amendment. They call it the Citizenship Amendment. And the propaganda completely changes. In previous campaigns, women suffragists would say women are equal or women are going to protect the home, these kinds of messages that they had heard up until this point. Now they're saying you should support the Citizenship Amendment because you are 100% American, right? We don't want any slackers, is what they say. And really what that means is you might be considered a German enemy, and they do actually say they think that these German enemies are going to sabotage the United States through the ballot box. So they're really pivoting away from this idea that this is just about women to a broader question about who should vote. And their answer is whoever is loyal.
And that ties in beautifully with what Josh Lynn said last month and the fact that this fight for women's rights and for the vote for women really then comes into issues of exclusion, and that just because some people have the right to vote doesn't mean everybody has the right to vote. And there's that negotiating element.
Right.
And so, as you see from the ratification 100 years later, do you see any of those trends that are present in the Midwest in the time that you're researching? Are these things that you continue to see resonate in current events today?
Oh, yes. So I think this helps us tell harder stories than we might often want to tell. I think sometimes we want to look at movements and we want to say that these women sacrificed and they worked so diligently. And in the end, they convinced people that women ought to be equal. And that's not necessarily the case. They did that work, it's true, but they also worked to exclude people. And I think it resonates with us to consider how we even now build partnerships and coalitions and messages. And it makes us think about who are we including in those messages and who are we excluding for our own purposes. I think a lot about the kinds of activism that we see. And I think this story gives us some pause to really reconsider what kind of goal we have in mind and if that goal is actually going to do the things it's going to do. The reality in this case is that women's suffrage was not an inclusive movement. It was not for all women. And it also, in the process of gaining women the right to vote, excluded people who did have access to rights, these non-citizen voters. They lost a right. And we can talk about the reasons why and what we might think about non-citizen voting rights today. But it, I think, again, helps us see with more complexity how these coalitions and messages might not always be doing the things we think that they're doing.
Thank you so much.
EKU Professor of History Jackie Jay with Sarah Egge, author of Woman Suffrage and Citizenship in the Midwest, this month's guest in our series on women's suffrage.